Good morning. 9 o'clock, time for us to begin. We're in our study of the book of Esther. And let me remind everyone that audio from these lessons, as well as any handouts we have, all available on the internet at studyezra.com. Ezra, of course, is the other book we're studying, and that's the domain name if you want to get the audio, studyezra.com. This is lesson 14 in our study of Ezra and Esther. And we're taking it chronologically, so after we finish Esther, we'll go back to the book of Ezra and pick up with chapter 7, which is where we left off there. And hopefully today we will get to the first verse of Esther, because we're still in the introductory material, but I think today we will get to the first verse of the book of Esther. Let's begin our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we're thankful for this day you've given us, Father, another open door in which we can come and do your will and worship you and study your word, Father. We're thankful for all that you do for us, Father, and our prayer is that as we study this book of Esther, we will see how you operate in Esther's time, Father, and we will learn from that, Father, how your providence works and how you operate in our world today. And Father, we're so thankful that we can see you at work in our world and in our lives. And Father, most of all, we're thankful for Jesus and for his life, his perfect life, and his perfect sacrifice. And we're thankful that he's coming again. We pray these things in his name. Amen. When we ended last week, we were looking at the two major themes in the book of Esther. The theme of reversal and the theme of feasting or banquets. And we wondered why feasting would be a theme in a book like Esther. And one answer we considered was that the interplay in this book between feasting and reversal, between those two themes, reflects the interplay between God's providence and human behavior. And we're going to see that interplay all throughout the book of Esther. And what we saw was that the way God works in the book of Esther is really the way that God works today. Not with miracles, but behind the scenes through his providence for his people. So in that way, Esther is a very modern book. I think we can learn a lot from it from that perspective also. God is not hidden in Esther. God is veiled in Esther. I liked how one commentary described it. Visions and revelations may come and go, but the veiled presence of God is a constant that may not be seen or felt, but will always sustain his people in good, bad, and ugly times. This is the precious truth that the book of Esther shows us. But the events in Esther encourage us really to look behind that veil. The events in Esther encourage us to look at what's really going on behind the scenes when we lift that veil. And the key way that the book of Esther does that is by not mentioning God at all. In fact, as we mentioned, God is not mentioned in the book of Esther. Why? What better way to illustrate the veiled nature of God? What better way to illustrate God's unseen role in history? What better way to encourage faithfulness, even when it appears that God is hidden? It does not mention God at all. But is God really veiled in Esther? Those who look for God will find God, even in Esther. In chapter 4, verse 3, what did the Jews do in response to the edict from Haman? They fasted. They fasted. What purpose would fasting have except to affect God's will directed toward God? I think the veil is pretty thin in that verse. And don't we see an allusion to God in the statement that Mordecai makes in Esther 4, verse 14? For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. Who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Another place? Another place? Isn't that a reference to God? At the very least, there's a strong confidence in Mordecai's part that deliverance will come. Well, where was that deliverance going to come from except from God? And why should Mordecai add that threat to Esther and to her family that's in that verse I just read, unless he's thinking of the consequences in the law for those who are disobedient to God's will? And the phrase, for such a time as this, for such a time as this, don't we see Mordecai there seeing a design in these events? And if there's a design in these events, isn't there a designer? A designer? You can find God in the book of Esther. You just have to look. He's there all throughout the book of Esther. Perhaps the most intriguing evidence for God in the book of Esther is found in other biblical events, links to other biblical events that you read about in the or you see in the book of Esther, a parallel in the book of Esther. God blessed Joseph and gave him favor before Potiphar, Genesis 39. God gave the Israelites favor before the Egyptians, Exodus 12, 36. Esther simply gains favor, Esther 2, 15. But wouldn't anybody reading that in the second chapter of Esther be thinking, this is like Joseph. This is like the Israelites. This is God giving the favor here. That's why that language is used. So the careful student of God's word will see God in that language in Esther chapter 2. The Israelites cry out to God in Exodus 2, 23. The Jews in Esther simply cry out, Esther 4, verse 3. But the careful reader is going to see that and think, they're crying out to God. God promised personally to put the fear of the Jews among their enemies in the promised land, Deuteronomy 2, 25. In Esther, simply the enemies of the Jews fear them, Esther 8, 17. But why? Because of God. And when you read through the book of Esther and you think about the other events that have already happened in the Bible, you're thinking, this is God at work here. We see God at work in here because we see God doing the same things in the other events that came before. These events, I think, are inviting the careful student of the Bible to find God on every page of Esther, every verse of Esther, all throughout the book of Esther. But we still have the question, if all of these allusions and coincidences point to God, why is God not named? I love what one commentary said on that point. It's a little longer quote than I usually read, but let me read you what they said. When we think of redemptive history, we think of the great miracles that display God's power. But these mighty acts of God are linked together through long years of human history by a chain of seemingly insignificant, ordinary events. We are now living in one of those long stretches of history between the ascension and return of Christ. Like Xerxes of long ago, modern kings, presidents, and rulers make decisions from purely political motives. Like Vashti, people today unwittingly make decisions that have long-reaching consequences far beyond what they could have foreseen. These events may be completely secular and perhaps made by people who give Christ no thought. Nonetheless, through them, God is moving all of history forward to accomplish His will. That's what we're seeing in the book of Esther. That's what we're seeing in the first chapter of Esther, in which we have no Jews, none of God's people. We have purely secular people doing secular things in the first chapter of Esther. But can't we see how important that first chapter is to the rest of the book? That's what we're seeing at play here. The book of Esther assumes that there are two dimensions to reality, which we know is not just an assumption, but it's the truth. One that is seen and one that is unseen. Esther is herself a person with two identities. She has two names, one of which means hidden. The root form for the Hebrew word Esther is Sater, which means concealment or hidden. On the surface, to be a faithful Jew would require a return to Jerusalem and an observance of temple worship there in Jerusalem and testing your Jewish pedigree, the things that we've seen in Ezra. But being a faithful Jew meant so much more than that, which we've also seen in Ezra, and which you see throughout the Bible. Paul talks about it in the book of Romans. What it really means to be a faithful Jew, it means so much more than just the surface observances. And in this case, it meant, I think, what it still means today to be a faithful child of God, and that means that you're showing God to the world. That when people look at you, they're seeing God. They're seeing Christ in your actions, in your priorities, in your deeds, and in your words. You're showing, you're displaying God to the world. That's what it meant then, that's what it means now. And if that's what it meant then, perhaps God is not hidden or veiled at all. But you're seeing God in the actions of Esther, in the actions of God's people in the book of Esther. God is not hidden in the book of Esther. Another place to look for God in the book of Esther is to look at the narrator of the book of Esther. This narrator is omniscient. This narrator knows conversations. This narrator knows private thoughts that were going on inside people's heads. This narrator knows what's going on inside the king's palace. Who else would know these things but God? Who else would know these things but the Holy Spirit who authored this text? The providence of God is on display in the book of Esther. And that means God is on display in the book of Esther, on display for all to see. And I think the providence of God also explains something else we'll talk about some more later, and that is the book's humor. The book's humor. There is, despite the seriousness of what's going on here, I mean, it's very serious events, a threat to the entire Jewish race from Haman, there's still a lightness to this text. And it's undeniable. There's some humor in this text. And I think what that is that's optimism that's shining through from the very first chapter through the end. Esther is an optimistic book. Someone reading this and understanding how God works and protects and provides for his people, they're going to be optimistic. They're going to know how this is going to turn out. And in fact, it does turn out that way. But the reader is going to see that and know that. And I think that explains the humor, the lightness, the optimism that shines through in this otherwise very serious book. Now, another way to look at Esther is to see it as a conflict between competing worldviews. And we sure have that today, don't we? One of the worldviews in the book of Esther is represented by Haman, who believed in fate, and fortune, and tried to destroy his enemies that way. And that belief in fate was really pervasive in the ancient world. That led through the astrology and the omens and the magical practices. That was all that worldview that was swept up in fate and the god of fate. So strongly condemned in the Old Testament, all those practices. And you hear today about the New Age beliefs. I mean, one thing about New Age is it's certainly not new, right? It's been around since the Garden. It's been around for so long. And it certainly was not new. And that's, you could see Haman's worldview as kind of that New Age belief in fate. In fact, the Feast of Purim that was established here in the book of Esther, Purim means lots, throwing lots. So in fact, the whole book is kind of wrapped around that concept of fate. And of course, the biblical worldview is completely different from that, completely different from that fatalism of Haman. God is the Lord of history. And although he has made us responsible for our decisions and our actions, and he's given us free will, God is in control and God is moving history forward to fulfill his will. And you can see that going as God is moving everything forward to fulfill his will. That's the way history operates, and that's the biblical worldview. And you could almost see Esther as a conflict between that way of working and Haman's view of things. When was Esther written? Well, the first thing you look at, and I would say that both liberals and biblical scholars do the same thing. They look at the book to see if there are any prophecies in the book. And they use that to help them determine when it was dated. Except they reach opposite conclusions. A liberal looks at the book and says, well, there's a prophecy there pointing to so-and-so a date. Therefore, the book must have been written after that date. The biblical view, the faithful view, the Bible-believing view is to look at it and say, oh, there's a prophecy here. Therefore, we know it was written before that date. But they both look for a prophecy. Unfortunately, when you look at Esther, you're not going to find any of those. So that doesn't help us. All we can say with absolute certainty is that the book was written after around 465 BC, because that's when Xerxes was there and he's in the book, and before AD 70. Wow, that's late. But at least we know by AD 70, Josephus had included events from Esther in his book, The Antiquities. So that's a very broad window, but we'll start with that one. Now, there's some evidence that Esther was translated into Greek by Lysimachus. And if that's the case, we'd move it back from AD 70 to more like 70 BC, maybe 112 BC. So we can move it in a little bit if, in fact, that's the case. Most modern scholars date the book in the 3rd century BC during the Greek rule in Palestine, which I think is much too late. That's also what they do to the book of Daniel, which does contain prophecies, as we know. But they also put Esther in that time frame. Others, I think, are correct when they point to a much earlier date for the book of Esther. Some, for example, say, well, look at the language that's used in the book of Esther. They say it's pointing toward a late 5th century date, much earlier than the modern scholar. There's really a lack of any Greek cultural references in the book of Esther. And we know Alexander the Great would take over pretty soon afterwards, and that apparently had not happened yet. There are no words of Greek origin. There are a lot of words of Persian origin. And as we've already seen, the book has a very accurate knowledge of what was going on in Susa and with the Persians. All that's pushing me toward a much earlier date than the modern liberal scholar would say. You know, one way to date any text, even today, is to look at linguistics, the language that's used. If I handed you a sheet of paper and said, was this written in the 1700s, in the 1800s, or the 1900s, you could probably tell me that, right? You could look at it and say, well, let me look. The language, the word choice, the way it's arranged in sentences, the length of the sentences. I mean, you could look at it and probably give me a pretty good ballpark for when it was written. Well, scholars can do the same thing with ancient Hebrew Aramaic text. And when they do that, they're saying this is pointing to a much earlier date. Just to give one example of that, one of Haman's sons in chapter 9, verse 9, is Vaizatha. V-A-I-Z-A-T-H-A. Well, apparently, one of the commentaries said that diphthong, there's a flash from the past on English class, that diphthong, A-I, became an E after Xerxes and before Artaxerxes. There was a shift in the language, and the spelling would have been different. I guess they can tell that from the tablets and things they've dug up. And they say the fact that just those two letters in that word are pointing to a much older date than a lot of scholars are willing to admit. I think Esther was certainly written during the Persian period, no later than 350 BC and possibly earlier. Who wrote it? Who was the human author of the inspired text? Of course, we're not told. We don't know for sure. Some have suggested Ezra. Some have suggested Mordecai. We just don't know. Questions about the introductory material in Esther before we start verse 1. Chapter 1, verse 1, Book of Esther. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces, being before him. Well, as we discussed in the introduction, feasting is one of the major themes in the book of Esther. And in fact, Esther begins with a feast given to King Xerxes, given by King Xerxes. The events of the banquet lead to the king's anger against Queen Vashti. It leads to Vashti's sudden departure. That departure sets the stage for Esther and all the events that follow. So this is a very important feast, a very important banquet for all that's about to follow. Verse 1 begins with the phrase, "Now it came to pass." All right, the modern liberal commentary who starts off and tells me this is fiction, I start off and say, okay, so you either believe that phrase or you don't believe that phrase. And if you think that first phrase, that first word out of the mouth of the author of Esther, if that's a lie, why do you keep reading? Now it came to pass. And that's the same kind of introduction you find, for example, in Joshua. Joshua 1, verse 1. Now after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass. It's the same phrase you find in Judges, Judges 1, verse 1. Now, after the death of Joshua, it came to pass. In fact, if you look for the phrase, "it came to pass," you will find that 453 times in the Bible, old and new. In fact, you'll find it 40 times in the book of Luke, talking about Jesus doing things. It came to pass. Those who argue that Esther is not historical, they're going to have to explain why their reasoning would also not apply to the rest of the Bible that also says it came to pass over and over and over again. These events came to pass. They occurred. This is history. Right from the beginning. Ahasuerus. Well, we've talked about that. That's the Hebrew form of the Persian king called Xerxes by the Greeks. And I'm not even going to attempt the Persian form. But Ahasuerus is the Hebrew form. Xerxes is the Greek form. When the Greeks came up to a name they couldn't pronounce, they just came up with their own Greek name and called him that. That's how we came up with Xerxes. I'll probably call him Xerxes most in these lessons, even though the text here is using the Hebrew form, Ahasuerus. We've already seen him briefly. We saw him in Ezra 4, verse 6. Remember, that was when Ezra stepped out of the timeline and shot forward a little bit in time to explain other events that had occurred. And one of the things he talked about was something that happened early in the reign of King Xerxes, Esther 4, verse 6. But that's not the only place we saw him. We also saw him in Daniel 11, verse 2. Not by name, but Daniel there was telling us about Xerxes 100 years before Xerxes was born. So that was a prophecy of Xerxes in Daniel 11, verse 2. Now, Xerxes reigned from 486 to 465. And, his father was Darius the Great. And Xerxes inherited his kingdom from Darius the Great. And Xerxes had a gigantic kingdom from India to Ethiopia, as verse 1 tells us. And as history completely confirms, he had a huge reign. In fact, he probably had the largest empire known up until that time. Now, critics argue that the 127 provinces mentioned in verse 1 is inaccurate because they say Herodotus listed only 20. But fair-minded critics notice that different words are being used there. The 127 is to a province. It's a subdivision of a satrapy, which is what Herodotus lists. Daniel 2:49 talked about the province of Babylon. Ezra 2, Nehemiah 7 talked about the province of Judea. That's what it's referring to here. As for the different numbers between Daniel and Esther, well, keep in mind it's different dates, right? Very different dates. I could point you to any number of sources that would say the United States has 48 states, right? But you'd understand that to say, oh, well, that was written back then. Now we got 50. So that would explain the different numbers between the different time frames. One interesting suggestion I saw in the 127, interesting and wrong, was that they said, well, 127 is symbolic. They said 12 is the number of God's people and 10 is the number of completeness and 7 is the number of perfection. Therefore, 127 is no. Now, when we're studying apocalyptic language like we did in Daniel, then yes, the rule is for apocalyptic language, you first assume it's figurative unless there's a reason to think otherwise, because that's what apocalyptic language is. But this is not apocalyptic language. This is history. So with history, you assume it's literal, unless there's some reason to believe otherwise, and there's certainly no reason here to believe otherwise. You need to be very careful of any commentary that tries to find some figurative meaning about every single number in the Bible. And there are commentaries like that. There's an entire series called the Numerical Bible that tries to do that on every number mentioned everywhere in the Bible. Numbers can be symbolic, and we've seen that in our study of the book of Daniel, but that's a particular type of language, apocalyptic language, which doesn't occur that often in the biblical text. Now, Susa was Shushan in the King James Version, but it's Susa, that's the city of Susa. That was the capital of ancient Elam. Darius I had rebuilt it, and he used it as his main residence before he later moved his capital to Persepolis. Xerxes also had his main residence in Persepolis, where it had moved, but he lived in Susa during the winter. He wintered in Susa. Daniel had a vision there, Daniel 8, verse 2, we saw that. Later, Nehemiah would be serving in Susa as the cupbearer to Xerxes' son, Artaxerxes, and we'd see that in Nehemiah 1:1. So Susa is a central, important city all throughout these events. Daniel, Esther, Ezra, Nehemiah, and that's where these events are taking place. Now, Xerxes ascended to the throne in 486, as I mentioned. He was 32 years old. The third year of his reign was 483 BC, and that was a few years before his famous expedition to the Greek mainland, which ended in disaster. Now, rulers used banquets. Why? Why did they have feasts? Well, they had feasts to show their greatness and to show their power and also to reward their loyal subjects. All that's in play here. Herodotus described banquets that had 15,000 guests. The Assyrian king, Ashurnerzapal, once gave a feast with 70,000 guests. These were gigantic events, feasts. If you go to the Louvre Museum in Paris, you will see a part of a wall with many colored mosaics on it, on display in that museum. That piece of that wall came from the great banquet hall built by Darius in Susa. And that's where these events are taking place. So, in fact, you could go visit something that Esther and Xerxes, that they saw with their own eyes, and you could go see it today in Paris. Verse 3 refers to Persia and Media rather than to Media and Persia. And that ordering is important. And that ordering is another point that shows us the historical accuracy of this book. Prior to the days of Cyrus, the Medes were in charge. They had been the dominant partner. But Cyrus won the allegiance of both nations and united them. Why? Because Cyrus's father was Persian and his mother was Median. And when Cyrus did that, Persia then later became the dominant player. And by the time of Xerxes, Persia was by far the dominant partner. So it's Persia and then Media. Verse 3 gives us a time frame. And you know how important time frames are. We always look for a time frame, and we get that. The third year of Xerxes' reign. We've mentioned that already. And we know from extra-biblical history that Xerxes' campaigns against the Greeks began just a few years after this and ended 4 years after this. 4 years. Keep in mind, we're in the third year of his reign. History tells us that's pretty soon after that's when the Greek campaign began. It ends 4 years later. 4 years later. What happens? 3 to 4, that's the seventh year of his reign. Look at Esther 2:16. Esther's reign as queen began when? Seventh year of Xerxes' reign. That's an unexplained gap, unless we're point to what history tells us, and that is that Xerxes was occupied with the Greeks during that time, and when he came back from the Greek campaign, came back in disaster, I would point out, weakened, I would point out. That's when he then marries Esther, and that would also explain why Esther is not mentioned in the book of Herodotus, because Herodotus' interest in Xerxes ends with the Greek campaign. I think it also may explain what we'd already seen about Xerxes back in Ezra chapter 4, verse 6. Remember that verse, we just talked about it, but that's the verse where Ezra steps out of the timeline and he says, look, the enemies of God's people sent a letter to Xerxes early in his reign complaining. And then you're waiting to hear, okay, now what did Xerxes say in response? Ezra never tells us. There's no response recorded. Well, why do you think Xerxes did not respond to that letter he got early in his reign? Because he was fighting the Greeks, right? I mean, he wasn't there to respond. He was interested in other things. I think that also explains why they never got a response that was even was recorded anyway in Ezra 4, verse 6. So in the first three verses then of Esther, we have the setting for all that will follow, at least in chapter 1, the Persian court in Susa in the 5th century B.C., and we're going to see that's certainly chapter 1, and then it continues on with the seventh year as we get into chapter 2. Verse 4. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 104 days. And when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan, the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days, in the court of the garden of the king's palace, where were white, green, and blue hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse from one another, and royal wine in abundance, according to the state of the king. And the drinking was according to the law, none did compel. For so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Well, these verses, verses 4 through 8, are telling us about the splendor of King Xerxes' palace. They're telling us about Persia's wealth, Persia's magnificence. And in fact, that wealth and that magnificence dazzled even Alexander the Great, who more than a century later would enter this same palace. And he would find 1,200 tons of gold and silver, 270 tons of gold coins, all in this palace. So even 100 years later, Alexander himself would be dazzled by the great wealth that was on display here. Excavations at Susa between 1884 and 1886 produced many treasures from this same palace, one of which I've already mentioned. You can go see them in the Louvre Museum in Paris. The same critics who were complaining about the 127 satrapies or provinces, they also complain about the 180-day banquet in verse 4. But the language doesn't say there was a 180-day banquet in verse 4, does it? More likely than not, the 180 days was some kind of a public event. But the banquet, when it gets to it, tells us it lasted 7 days in verse 5. What was going on in this banquet? Why were they even having this banquet? Well, I think what was going on was that they were planning that Greek campaign that was going to come very shortly after this. I think that's what's going on. In fact, if you read Herodotus, Herodotus talks about a great war council that occurred in 483 BC. That's where we are. 483 BC. In book 7 of his histories, here's what Herodotus says. After the conquest of Egypt, when he was on the point of taking in hand the expedition against Athens, it's Greek, Xerxes called a conference of the leading men of the country to find out their attitudes toward the war and to explain to them his own wishes. Herodotus records the words of Xerxes at that council. For this cause I have now summoned you together that I may impart to you my purpose. And he then goes on to explain to them the upcoming Greek invasion. And he tells them they're going to receive lavish gifts and support if they support him in this. It is so important to him. Think about that for a moment. He's got all the nobles and all the powerful people there, and he's saying, you follow me. I'm going to defeat Greece, and you're going to be rich, rich, rich. It is so important for Xerxes to display his power and his command and his authority. So anything that makes him look powerless at this banquet, do you think it's going to make him happy or make him mad? It's going to upset him to no end. And that's a bit of foreshadowing, because he's about to get upset by someone who makes him look completely powerless in front of his rulers and his military generals. We're going to see that in just a moment, but you know, we've got to get the setting in place to really understand the impact that has on him. This is not an ordinary feast. This is a feast planning the invasion of the Greek mainland. Now, verses 6 through 7, they show us the incredible luxury of this palace. Over and over, you can see it all through the verses I just read. Herodotus relates an incident that occurred during Xerxes' retreat from Greece. Remember, this turns out badly. So there's a whole section of Herodotus showing Xerxes running scared. And in one of the scenes in Herodotus, it shows Xerxes left so quickly, he left his tent behind in an abandoned camp. Okay, well, the Greeks rush in to see what's in the king Xerxes' tent. And what they find are gold and silver couches. Couches, complete couches made of gold and silver that they had left behind. The Herodotus says the Greeks were amazed. They said, what would such a rich king want with Greece in the first place? But he was running with all his riches. That's the kind of wealth that King Xerxes had. And we see it on display here in chapter 1. Now the word translated edict or law in verse 8, that's used 19 times in this book, each time with reference to a royal decree, a royal law. Literally, verse 8 says, and the drinking was according to the law that there be no restraining, that there be no restraining. Usually, in ancient times, there would be something like a toastmaster, you might call them today, who would kind of indicate when everyone was supposed to drink and when they weren't supposed to drink, that kind of a thing. But that's not what we see here. What we see here is they could drink whenever they wanted to, as much as they wanted to, for 7 days. As one commentary said, this was not just luxurious, this was licentious. I mean, that was what was going on here. It might even remind us of another drunken feast we saw in Daniel chapter 5. Remember that drunken feast and how that ended? That's how the Persians came into power. They don't seem to have learned much from the lesson of the Chaldeans in Daniel 5. These introductory verses, though, they're showing us something. I mentioned already they're showing us the theme of feasting. But we're already seeing the other theme, reversal. We're seeing the theme of reversal already in these opening verses. Everybody who originally read chapter 1 knew exactly how these events were going to turn out. They knew exactly what was going to happen with Xerxes. They knew he was going to come back a total failure from his campaign to try to take over the Greeks. They knew he would come back with depleted power, with a depleted treasury. They knew the great reversal that was just a few years ahead of King Xerxes. They all knew that. And yet, so when they're reading this, they're already thinking, boy, this guy's going to get it. This guy's going to get a reversal. They're already thinking that as they're reading that. This unstated reversal is setting the stage for all the reversals that are going to occur in this book. And you can already see it here, right at the very beginning of the text. You know, the book of Esther could have very easily started off that way. There was a great King Xerxes, and let me tell you what happened to him in Greece. No, it doesn't start off that way. It starts off when Xerxes was still very much in his power, and then it completely skips over the Greeks until we get to year 7. It completely skips over that. Why? Because the reader knew that, and that's the reversal that the reader's seeing. It doesn't have to be spelled out for the reader. The reader knows that reversal in King Xerxes' life. I think there may be one more hint about reversal here, though. That elaborate description of that palace that I just read, all the marble and all the colors and all the purple and all that stuff, where else have we seen such an elaborate description of a structure? The temple. In fact, other than the temple, this structure probably gets the largest treatment in Scripture other than the temple with regard to that. You know, the temple had been magnificent in the days of Solomon, but it's not magnificent anymore, right? I mean, it's been rebuilt, but as we saw in the book of Ezra, it's on a much lesser, less grand scale, paid for by the Persians, not paid for as Solomon did out of his own pocket, paid for by the Persians. I think perhaps God is wanting those who read this to see that the beauty and the magnificence of Solomon's temple, it's now in the Persian structure. It's been moved. It's now over here. And along with the people of God who are also living in Persia, all the magnificence is there. People of God, hadn't the people of God themselves encountered a great reversal from the days of Solomon to the day they're now living in? And of course, that reversal was caused by their disobedience and their idolatry. But I think this book is inviting us to see that as well, that God's people had suffered a great reversal just to be here in the first place. And Xerxes was also going to suffer a great reversal. So I think just in the opening 8 verses of Esther, we've now seen both of the main themes, feasting and reversal. Verse 9. Also Vashti, the queen, made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Well, verse 9 tells us about another feast, Queen Vashti's feast. It tells us she had liberty to make such decisions. She gave her own feast. She was powerful. Later we'll see Queen Esther also exercising her own power and her own authority. Verse 9, though, shows us the king and queen are acting separately, maybe a bit of foreshadowing for trouble to come, perhaps. And for anyone who wonders whether feasting is really a theme in the book of Esther, we're now in verse 9 and we're in our second feast, possibly our third, depending upon whether the feast in verse 3 is the same as the feast in verse 5. We've had certainly 2, maybe 3 feasts already by verse 9. So feasting is definitely a theme here. Now, women were present at the royal Persian banquets. Herodotus tells us that. But typically they would separate when? When the drinking started. And the women would go one way and the men would go the other way, but not all the women would leave. The concubines were left for entertainment after the other women left. And in fact, Josephus would later explain Vashti's decision as just a reluctance to break that protocol, perhaps. Well, what happens next? Verse 10. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mahuman, Bistha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abigtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the 7 chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the royal crown, to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. But the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth, and his anger burned in him. Verses 10 through 12, they show us the command from the king, and they show us the queen's denial of that command. She refused to come. Verse 4 tells us that Xerxes wanted to display his splendor, wanted to display his glory, and the beautiful Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, would have been seen as a living trophy of his splendor and of his glory, and that's what he wanted to show. Now, he sends 7 chamberlains, as the King James says. Your translation may say 7 eunuchs, I think is a better translation, to go and get her. Why 7 eunuchs? I think the eunuch part is self-explanatory. Why 7? Well, some suggest that may have been the number they needed to carry her in her royal litter. Maybe it was also made of gold. In any event, they're listed by name here, which happened for a reason. It serves to verify the event, right? It's a historical event. We have their names. Do we really think that they're just making this up? I mean, that's what anyone who says this is fiction has to believe that the author just made up these names. We have their names to show its history, to verify the event. Now, Herodotus tells us something interesting about the Persian view of alcohol. Persians drank when they deliberated matters of state. Here's what Herodotus says about it. Moreover, it is the Persians' custom to deliberate about the gravest matters when they are drunk. And what they approve in their councils is proposed to them the next day by the master of the house where they deliberate, when they are now sober. And if being sober they still approve it, they act thereon. But if not, they cast it aside. And when they have taken counsel about a matter, when sober, they decide upon it when they're drunk. That's how the Persians operated. They waited till they were drunk. They came up with ideas. Someone apparently who was not drunk would write them down, and then they would think about them when they were sober, and if they still liked them, they'd go with it. That's the way the Persians operated. This drinking was for a purpose. It was because they were about to deliberate the most important thing they were going to do in a long time, and that is invade Greece. And when you see how that turned out, it makes it very understandable they came up with it when they were drunk. Now, the ancients believed that this intoxication put them closer in touch with the spiritual world. That's why they were doing this. And it was an essential element of things such as this war council. And if that's the case, don't we have yet another historical fact confirmed by the book of Esther? Now, a key event in the entire book occurs in verse 12. Queen Vashti refuses to come to Xerxes, the most powerful person on earth. Why? Why? Why did she do that? That's a question we're going to ask many times in our study of the book of Esther, not just about Vashti. What was the motivation? What were they thinking? What were they trying to do? What was their purpose? For some people in the book of Esther, we're told that. For others, we're not. We just have to speculate. We can look at what happened, but we don't know what was going on inside their head. We're not told. Vashti falls in that latter category. So, of course, the speculation runs rampant, and it always has with Vashti. Perhaps she's just acting on a whim. Oh, I don't want to go today. Now, here's how one commentary described it. Vashti could have been motivated by any of the following: anger, pride, disdain, dignity, modesty, marital fidelity, love, royal decorum, or early feminism. Any of these motives or a heady cocktail of them all could have prompted her refusal. One thing is certain, refuse she did, and in doing so, she set in motion an epoch-making train of events. All we know is that she refused. We don't know why. Now, Herodotus does describe another banquet at which the women present were assaulted by the drunken men who were drinking at that banquet. Herodotus does tell us about that in another instance. And as we talked about last week, any woman would have been reluctant to have appeared before a group of men who had been drinking for 7 days, which is what Vashti had been invited to do. And yet this was not just any woman. This was not just any woman. This was the royal wife of King Xerxes of Persia. And this was not just any event. This was the great war council in which Xerxes was planning his invasion of Greece, at which he most needed to impress his generals and his princes with his royal power and his authority. Vashti could hardly have picked a worse time to refuse the king's request. So again, we have to ask why. Well, maybe Vashti was opposed to the Greek invasion, and she just didn't want it to happen. If so, she knew what she was doing. It was a bad idea. Perhaps there was a conflict between the royal command and existing Persian law, which we know cannot be broken. Josephus suggests that Vashti refused to appear before the king out of regard to the law of the Persians, which forbid the wife to be seen by strangers. Usually they would have been veiled, and I guess in this case she would have had to have her veil off to show her great beauty. The Jewish rabbis are very interesting to read, because when they didn't have an answer in the text, they just made all kinds of stuff up. But they created these legends and these traditions, and of course we see Jesus' response to all their traditions of men when we get to the New Testament, but they would do that. And here's what they said. They said the reason Vashti did not appear before the king is that the king had commanded her to appear before him naked. How do they get that? They say, well, look at verse 11. Wearing only her royal crown. Except, of course, that's a little rewrite of verse 11, right? It doesn't say only her royal crown. It just says a royal crown. But they put in the word only and said that's all she was going to wear, and she refused to do that. But you know, with the rabbis, that wasn't enough for them, because they could not see why such a shameless creature as Vashti, as they considered her, would be unwilling to come before the king even in that condition. They thought, well, Vashti would do that. So what did they come up with? They said the angel Gabriel had come to her and had afflicted her with leprosy, and that's why she didn't appear. This is all in the Jewish traditions and in all the additions they've added to God's word, and they just spin on and on. In fact, they also say that Vashti was the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, the daughter of Belshazzar, There is zero evidence for that. There is zero evidence in the text for any of that. It's just the Jewish tradition being made up to go along with the biblical text. Now, we mentioned one intriguing theory earlier with Vashti, and that we talked about was that Vashti may be the same person as Amestris, who is the queen of Xerxes from Herodotus. And if that's the case, Artaxerxes, the king's son, would have been born right about now. He was 18 when he came to power, and that was about 18 years from this event. So that means that Vashti, if she's the same as Amestris, may have been pregnant with the future king Artaxerxes, and that may have been why she refused to go to that banquet. That fits very well with what we know from extra biblical history. Next week, we'll start with this question. We're struggling to figure out the motivation. Why did Vashti do this? Why did she do it? Why did she refuse to come? A bigger question is this. Why aren't we told? Why doesn't the Bible tell us why she didn't do that? And we'll start with that question next week. Thank you very much for your attention.